This thing has been shown over 100 million times, 100 million viewers in 60 countries. And now we have a potential movie because of that.
As a journalist, I was in awe of the Netflix documentary, The Pharmacist. What was so fascinating to me was the way that the central character, pharmacist Dan Schneider, was a meticulous record keeper and great investigator. He was recording audio and video long before we had smartphones in our hands, and he was doing it to catch his son's killer in a drug deal gone bad, and later shut down pill mills in the opioid crisis.
I made a bargain with God. I said, look, God, if you will protect me, and if you help me get my son's killer off the street, I will go on a mission for you. For the rest of my life, I will try to prevent this happening to every other family.
I was thrilled when Dan agreed to join me on my podcast because he had so much to say. We actually are bringing you his story in two parts because his mission hasn't ended. He is quite the character with his New Orleans accent and colorful way of storytelling. I think you'll enjoy this podcast, and if you haven't already watched The Pharmacist on Netflix, you'll want to do it after listening. Well, Dan, I want to thank you so much for coming on my podcast. I just thought it was incredible the way the story was told, all of your role in it, your family's role in it, how it was edited. I mean, it's just so well done.
It really, really was. I had doubts as it was going through the process. I never went through this before, and yet it couldn't have been done any better. They did an excellent job. And it's funny, because God has kind of been involved in this and raised. And it's really funny, though, because there was a story that came on the local newspaper, Nolan.com, A Justice for Danny. And they had written this story about me. And it was really 15 years, basically, I had done most of my work. And it went real big. And then people start talking about documentaries and movies. And eventually a group called Cinemort, who actually did the sizzle reel, and then actually Netflix bought it, but they let Cinemort produce it under their supervision. But they did just an incredible job. Okay, they really did. And they decided to release it right when this hurricane was kind of on the way. Okay, now it kind of like skirted us a little bit. We got pieces of it. Okay, but I said, God dang it. I said, man, they're going to release this right now. And people will be so focused on a storm that it's not going to have the impact that I wanted to have. Just the opposite. People had nothing else to do. Now coming to the documentary, they release this documentary. What happens 2 weeks later? COVID. And I go, oh, crap, this is going to destroy it. It blew it apart.
Right.
It's a good story. But nobody had nothing to look at. All they could do was look at TV. This thing has been shown over 100 million times, 100 million viewers in 60 countries. And now we have a potential movie because of that.
I want to go back to when your son was killed, because your story, I mean, when you watch a documentary like this, everything just seems to sort of fall into place naturally. And I think of all of the years that you've spent first trying to catch your son's killer, trying to bring him to justice, followed by recognizing when the opioid crisis was starting and what was happening, when so few people were even recognizing what was going on. Years and years of your life, I bet you never, ever imagined before any of this that your life would take this kind of turn, or these kinds of turns and twists and turns.
I have a passion and a mission too, though. It gave me a purpose in life. It really did. In a way, it's twisted, but it made me a better person. You're absolutely right. And it's going to sound selfish. You probably would say the same thing. If I could have my boy back, I'd give this all up.
Oh, yeah.
And I know we've done good, and probably there's been more good that happened, and I've saved more people than just my son, and you have too, but we're selfish. You know, I'd get it back in a heartbeat to forget about all this stuff, okay? Because it does take a toll on you and your family.
I agree 100% of what you're saying. So what's interesting to me is that many people will go through a tragedy like what we've experienced, the loss of a child, and they don't become activists. You know, you don't have to do this. And what you've done is far beyond anything I've done, but I know what it's like to be immersed in this world, to be immersed in the way your child died. You never really get to escape from it. I maybe think some people go on with their lives and they kind of tuck it away. I'm not really sure how they deal with it, but certainly that hasn't been your way to deal with it.
Just to give you an idea, it was circumstances. I look like this really tremendous story. Call it a hero, call it whatever you want. Okay. But
you are a hero. You are a hero.
There was a necessity in sex. Actually, what I did was better than grieving. It was the grieving process. Okay. First of all, somebody murdered my son. Okay. And what happens? Number one, all of a sudden, boy, you're stupid. You don't know nothing about addiction. You must have missed something. I go through that phase. I'm trying to figure out, trying to teach myself about addiction, because I used to have stigma about kids that had addictions.
Yes. 100%.
I'm embarrassed to say this. A couple of weeks before my son died, this kid was killed in the Ninth Ward, just like my son. And guess what I said? I said, I had sympathy. Okay, but I said, what do you expect? Not you deserve it. I don't think I was quite to the point of you deserve it. And yet, there was part of me would have never dreamed my kid would have did this.
I think most of us, you're educated, you're a pharmacist. You gave your kid the world. I could see that through the documentary. I did the same thing. And I think somehow we think that protects us from these kinds of things happening to our kids. Like if we're just good enough parents, if we just know enough, but that is truly not the case.
So immediately, I'm starting to rethink addiction. I'm saying, wait a second. I know this kid was a good kid. I know he was bright. I know he experimented a little bit. This picture of God, it being a moral failing or something, or shortcoming. All of a sudden, when it's your kid, and particularly, there are some kids that have a lot of issues, but my son didn't, okay? Then I go to the police thinking that we're going to file a murder because, my son's a drug user. Okay. And that's different than a killer. Okay. They couldn't see the difference.
They stigmatized because of the way he died. Just like if they take something with fentanyl, they're poisoned by fentanyl. They call it overdose. I call it fentanyl poisoning. But you're stigmatized by the way that you die, I think.
Right.
And I also think the police were incredibly corrupt at that time in New Orleans in the late 90s.
There wasn't corruption. At times, I thought that was even involved in my case. It was more of a case of old burnout guys that were overworked.
Nobody cared. Nobody cared.
They really didn't get another drug deal going bad. And actually, I don't want to cast my son as some angel and these other kids as bad kids, but a lot of these kids had long records. They had stolen from their parents. And I have sympathy for all that, okay? I can pass you that, okay? But, it was not unexpected when they got killed. They never, ever really looked to see that my kid was any different than any of the other ones. My kid had no record, had never had a rehab, no knowledge of drugs, okay, other than maybe some pot. They treated him. Let me tell you what they did at first. I started recording, okay, and it seemed like, why was this guy recording? Was it planned?
As an investigative reporter, I just want to thank you. If I was the documentarian and you handed me all of these tape recordings from that time, I would be falling down at your feet, thanking you, because what a way to tell the story. You recorded everything that you did before there were cell phones.
I agree. You don't even understand some of the things that I had to do to record people, too. I bought a car. It finally had an intercom system with the telephone. And back in the year 2000, it was one of the very first cars that had this thing. Because lots of times I would have to record, because some of these police, you can't record that because they have systems where you can't record them and they know you're recording. I would have to go in my car with a handheld recorder, and it would come through the call system.
What prompted you to start recording in the first place? How did that idea come to you?
I had to respond to situations. It was the only way to go. The first thing I did is I talked to the police about my son and whatnot, and I tried to give him a picture that he was a little bit different. And I knew there was going to be a little stigma and he might not want to work hard. And I tried to say, this was a different kid. He was a good kid, da, 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 da. And I told him, I said, let me give you a couple tips. I'll give you some of his friends' names because they might know something what went on and where he worked at, okay? When I got out to where my son worked, poor Tom, he was in college. He worked at a pizza. They go down there, and after they go down there, and I basically set them down there, okay, thinking maybe somebody through his pizza deliveries made this connection with these drugs or something, okay? And they ask the manager of the Pizza Hut one question. How much was Danny stealing? They didn't ask any other questions. And she told him, she said, Danny, he was my best employee. He was never short a penny. I get on the phone with them. What did they say? Well, they were stealing from you. It was like a gut punch. And I sort of said to myself, well, you know, I never even thought about that. Maybe he was. And we had our own departments, okay? And we, you know, on the slide, we would keep a little side on the cash. So, you know, somebody pay us cash, we put it on side. We wouldn't put it in the bank, okay? But we always had $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 in the house. And the kids had access to it. All they had to do was write a reason. So when the police told me that, much as I thought my kid was a good kid, I said, you know, maybe they probably were something I don't know. I went there almost sick and pulled out our box with the cash, expecting to find it short. Wasn't short a penny. Now I am really getting angry with these cops. You're supposed to be looking for a killer, not trying to determine if my son's a criminal. I would talk to them about some things and try to be contribute. And I would suggest, well, why don't you try doing this? And they probably didn't want to do what I said, but they would give me lip service and say, okay, we'll do that. And then about a week later, I would call them and I'd say, by the way, how did that thing work out? What thing? I said, the thing I asked you to do. You didn't ask us to do that. So now I say, them bastards ain't going to beat me. So it was out of necessity. It was only to make sure I wasn't crazy.
Many people would have given up at that point. Many people would have really just felt like they had no power and they couldn't do anything about it.
It became a competition. It wasn't only find my son's killer. It was beat the cops.
And you went through a phone book, found a witness. I mean, things that probably couldn't have happened as easily today, but you did find the killer.
Yes, yes. But remember, there's some strange twists in the story. It's an incredible story. While I was involved in it, I didn't start recording thinking it was a movie, okay, or I was preparing for a movie. But I started realizing I was living a movie. And there was a point in time where it became a necessity just to check my own sanity to make sure I knew what I had told them, okay. But then it became an investigatory too. Nobody could relate to what I was doing. Everybody was telling me I was going to get killed, that you shouldn't be doing this. And my wife struggled with this. She knew I was doing the right thing, but her friends would say, he's going to get killed. You're going to lose your son and your husband. So there was always this little bit of struggle. And I would go in my son's room at night. And that recorded, I'd have recorded cops with him. I record myself. I would pray. Some of that's shown in there. I would pray and I would beg God. And the recorder became my friend. It was just basic necessity of surviving and fighting through this. But you're right, something drove me. And I'll tell you what also drove me. Obviously, just like any other parent, I get mad and calm. And I start saying, well, you know, I wasn't a good enough person. I must have sinned. This must be some kind of punishment. But rather quickly, when all this stuff started happening, I had nowhere to turn. So I actually turned to God and I made a bargain with God. I said, look, God, if you will protect me and if you help me get my son's killer off the street and if you'll protect any witnesses I have so no innocents get hurt, I will go on a mission for you. For the rest of my life, I will try to prevent this happening to every other family. So that also drove me.
Dan says a conversation with his son shortly before he died also drove him to keep searching for answers.
A week before he died, I had done see a couple of signs. And we had done something. We had him drug tested at one time and whatnot and passed drug tests and everything else. So I saw a few signs, you know, just a week or two before he died. And I thought it was drugs. I even went to him and I said, son, are you doing drugs? And I'm naive. I think he's doing marijuana and he's doing a little too much of it. And he says, no, Dad. And I said, well, I said, you know, I'll have to be drug tested. And he says, go ahead. Well, I now knew he was lying, I think. Although he had beaten drug tests before, okay, for pot, which was all he was doing earlier when he was young. But he did say something to me, and it was a gift, and it also hurt. But now I realize it was a gift. He said, but Dad, I'm depressed. I said, something's going on, son. something's going on here. You've got to be straight with me. Okay, he says, then I'm depressed. So I immediately go, well, son, you're not suicidal, are you? No, Dad. I got great parents. I got a great girlfriend. I got a great life. I just don't know what I want to be, and I'm having trouble focusing, and I'm frustrated, and I'm having trouble sleeping. And I, like a good daddy and a pharmacist, say, look, son, a couple of days, I'm going to get you an antidepressant. I'm going to get you a sleep aid. In the meantime, drink a beer and maybe take a Benadryl that helps you go to sleep. But I also talked to him about his future because he wanted to be an architect. He was good at literature and reading and writing, and he was pretty good at actually drawing, okay? But he wasn't really good at math and all the other things you need to be an architect. So I said, son, look, take the pressure off yourself. Become a draftsman. There's nothing wrong with being a draftsman. They make pretty good money. It's a trade. Focus on that. And I said, if you can go beyond that, and I said, make a to-do list. Make a to-do list to keep yourself organized. He said, fine, Dad. Well, just a couple of days later, he comes to me and he says, Dad, you know what? I really, really liked that talk we had the other day. He says, and I'm going to do what you said. Well, I don't know what he's doing drugs, buying crack. I'm dealing with something that I think is the real problem. But he says something else. And this is motivating. He said, Dad, I'm going to go focus on architecture. But you know, I love to write. And it's going to be a part of my life. I'm going to write. And, you know, I don't know if I could ever make a living on it. One other thing I like to do, Dad, I want to discourage kids from doing drugs.
Wow.
Wow. Now, let me just tell you. And me and him had debates on it. She was awful. Legalized marijuana. He was kind of inclined toward drugs.
My daughter, yeah. Too. Same.
Well, you know what I said? This kid finally gets it. It totally misled me. It totally disarmed me.
But that is what has become of his life.
Now I realize he was trapped. He couldn't tell me.
He was too ashamed.
He was too ashamed. There was too much stigma. He thought he could get out of it himself, okay? But he wanted to tell me that, Dad, I get it. So now I have to spread that message. I got to spread it for Danny. Let me tell you something else that I found out. Okay, he dies. Okay, we got to have a funeral. I'm doing all these other things, trying to investigate addiction. But I'm also trying to find what the hell happened with him. When did this start? So at the funeral, some of his friends said, Mr. Danny, can we carry Danny's coffin? They want to be pallbearers. But I told the kids, look, I've got family members. I don't know. But I did pick one kid to carry the coffin. This was a kid that years earlier came to me and said, look, Mr. Danny, I hate to rattle on Danny. He says, smoke pot, but it looks like he's developing a habit. I'm a little worried about it. And that keyed us up, and we worked on an issue, whether we resolved it, I thought we did. In any event, I looked at that kid and said, hero. So I let him carry the coffin. Now, I didn't know what the other kid's involvement was. So after the funeral, a day or two later, again, part of my desire to see if I could figure out how to solve the case, I wanted to question them. Maybe they knew who he was dealing with. Maybe they knew something was going on. Well, sure enough, I get a lot of graveside confessions. You know, these kids had slept over the house in Boy Scouts with him. I mean, you know, all American stuff, basically good kids. And one of them at this meeting, after they tell me the ending's history, when they think he started, how he started, a couple of things come out. One kid says, Mr. Danny, why didn't you let us carry his coffin? And I said, because you guys carried his coffin before he died. Tough. And I have since apologized to them and befriended them, and a lot of them are helping with my mission now, okay? But at the time, I was angry because they knew what he was doing.
Right.
But guess what? Danny had asked them to help him. He did not want to do this. He admitted to them he didn't want to do this, that he had cravings. So they made a pact. A couple of them made a pact. Danny was supposed to call them. I found this all out later. Danny was supposed to call them. But Danny left the house that night, the fatal night, okay? Still living with us, still would check in with us and whatnot. Good news is we said, we love you, be careful, all those things. But it's good that you hear him say, I got good parents, a week before he dies. It's good that we say, we love you. These are gifts.
My last words between my daughter and I were, I love you. Our last texts were, I love you. And I always say that is an incredible gift. that I have going forward.
Right. Well, anyway, now back to these kids. Ricky, one of his friends, called 5 minutes after Danny left the house. We were late upon how Danny called both friends and left messages for them to get back with him. He was trying not to go out that night.
Oh, but they missed him because they didn't have cell phones. So his friends were trying.
If you watch the show, there's a lot of crazy things. And not everything can be put in that show. There's a lot of backstories. The police did do something. But the reason why they did something was the girl that eventually that I would find that became the witness, she called Crime Stoppers like a day after. But when they took this Crime Stopper tip in, the kid comes in. Now, he doesn't look like a killer. He's 15 years old. And there are other suspects out there that look worse than him. So the kid gets called in, and they say, all right, somebody has named you as the killer. Oh, no, 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 I didn't kill him, okay? But I saw exactly what happened. Now, later, when I talk to the cold case cops and other police, police 101 is you don't just accept what he says. He's been named. And they pretty much accept it, because if they get lucky, the case is solved. If he leads it to a killer and they got a witness, you need a witness and you need a killer. In that area, it's almost impossible to get both. So in their minds, this is a quick way to resolve this case. So I believe the kid is a witness.
What happened next is unbelievable. Dan strikes up a friendship with the 15-year-old boy, who a witness named as the killer, but the boy claims he's not, but saw Danny's murder take place.
Me and my wife go visit his grandmother on the Sunday, right? And he rides up on his bike. I read a poem to him. I'm going to read this poem to you. This poem is big called Story. My son wrote this poem when he was in high school. I read this to the kid. Of course, the kid's 15, and now I know it probably didn't have an impact. But I was trying to convince the kid to help me actually get the real killer. Not him. The one he named. And to get the police to believe him. After my son's death, his girlfriend found all his writings. And I started reading his writings. And he had written a very poignant poem about the death penalty. He was strongly against the death penalty. So I want to tell a kid, look, help me find his real killer. And I said, my son wrote this poem. I'll read this poem to you, son. I'll read it to his killer.
Dan reads his son Danny's poem titled, It's Like a Mystery Story.
Life burns. As Stephen King breaks down his words of glory, critics rave. The body of a killer will be placed in his long-awaited grave. The parents of his victims are charged the high price of admission to watch his pain, but their satisfaction is guaranteed, so everyone claims. A flip of the switch in the dark of the night, a cry in the distance, a life taken for spite. The day turns black, the light is gone, new killers are born. A director now awaits approval to promote a blockbuster hit. But in life, this story just doesn't fit. Or does it?
That's like a premonition of everything that has happened since his death.
Amen. You know what? It's crazy. He even talks about a movie. So now, I'll read this to the kid. You know what the kid says? Yeah, Danny took a wrong turn. I said, you know what? Danny did. Danny should not have been up there. Later on, I would actually find out that he took a real physical wrong turn up there. But I pointed out to him, Jeffrey, this is about a killer taking a wrong turn. I'm explaining to the killer the difference between a killer and a kid making a wrong turn to buy a drug. I know, it's bizarre.
I was also shocked in the documentary that Jeffrey agreed to be in the documentary.
And how they managed to get everybody and everything. We had the witness, we had the killer, we had the doctor.
And how do you feel about Jeffrey today?
I'm believing to that. This is still part of the story. Initially, I thought to myself, if I could find a killer, I want to kill him. Regardless of what my son had talked about. But on the other hand, I'm praying to God, and I start telling God, well, look, God, if we catch him, I don't want the death penalty. And my son's poem is in the background. So me and my wife commit that if we solve this thing, and even if there is a death penalty case, we're going to ask that, no. We wanted him punished or taken off the street, but we wasn't going to kill him. Now, remember, Jeffrey, the killer, is also helping me solve the murder. He's helping me find the gun. Me and him become friends. He called me Mr. Danny.
I always say, though, that the truth is stranger than fiction. It really is.
Well, it is. So in any event, finally I found his witness, and she tells me Jeffrey's the killer. I wasn't quite sure. Okay? He didn't look like a killer. So I'm doing all these dangerous things, and one of my neighbors comes over to me, and says, "Danny, look, you know, you keep going up there, you're going to get killed." And I said, "Yeah, well, I'm sorry, but I got to do what I got to do." And he said, "Well, look, let me just tell you something about me. We live in an upper middle class neighborhood. I have no idea this guy's background. He only lives 3 houses away, but I barely knew him. I'm cutting grass one day while the investigation's all still going on." He says, "I'll tell you what I'll do." He says, "I'll go up there with you. Hey, in my earlier years, I had a serious crack problem. Way more than with your son. I shot at people. I had beat up people. People shot at me. I lived up there for a while with death crack." And he says, "I will go with you. You can interview people and I'll be there. And if somebody comes after you, I got a gun. I wouldn't carry a gun." So we go a couple times. If he's getting a little aggravated, he says, "Tell you what." And this is another weird story. Very hard to believe, okay, but it's real. He says, "I know a retired drug dealer." And what I mean by retired drug dealer is he used to be the kingpin in that area, okay? But he's still in the know. I'm going to bring you to him, and I think he might be able to help you find out whether Jeffrey is the killer or this other party is the killer. He's pretty scientific about it. He says, "I want you to write down their names, okay? Tell me a little bit about the situation." And he says, "Okay, Mr. Snyder, I think I can get you an answer. After I know who it is, do you want me to have him killed?" Yeah. Yeah, it definitely wasn't crossed my mind because at the time now, my witness might get killed. She doesn't want to come forward because she's being threatened. Everybody, the DA, the police are all telling me, "You'll never, ever get any justice out of this thing. Even if it goes to court, you never win." And so, in a sense, I could have said, "Well, you know, I'm getting a killer off the street who might kill somebody else. That's the only way I can get justice. So, God, maybe you give me a pass on this." What stopped me? My son. His poem. He was 100% against it. Look, I asked him, "If your mother or your daughter, your sister get killed, how would you feel?" "No doubt about it, Daddy." That is what he said, and that is what he wrote. For one thing, I solved the case. I'm obligated now to back this up with God. God has sort of fulfilled his part of the bargain. But anyway, after 10 years, we go visit Jeffrey in jail.
What made you go visit him in jail?
A desire to make peace, to try to forgive him.
So I have a question about the forgiveness part, because in my daughter's case, it was a boyfriend that led her into this world, met her at a very young age. Nothing has ever really happened to this guy. And I struggle with forgiveness, but for this one person. Now, who knows, you know, if that's really the case. Were you able to forgive him?
For one thing, my wife says no. I say yes, and I think I have. I don't know whether I'm kidding myself, but I definitely make an effort at it. And I don't have the rage at him that I once had. So it's about as close to forgiveness as I think I can call it. But anyway, we sit down with Jeffrey. I also want to get a few more details to it. I got 99 pieces of the puzzle, okay, but I don't have 100 pieces of the puzzle. I still want to know exactly what happened. Well, Jeffrey's kind of a scatterbrain. He's still trying to cover his ass a little bit. He does admit guilt. He apologizes, okay? But actually, even before that, you know what he says? He says, "Mr. Danny, I want to thank you for saving my life." All of Jeffrey's friends, and I knew all of his friends because they were all runners for these drug dealers in that particular neighborhood, okay? They were all dead. They died on the street. Jeffrey, had he remained on the street, he was more likely to die on the street than me putting him in jail. My son would have wanted this kid to have another chance. I said, "Jeffrey, it wasn't me that saved your life. It was Danny."
There's truth in that.
And I said, "Do you remember that poem I read you?"
"Did he?"
"No." I said, "Jeffrey, when I was investigating, I ran into a man who said I could have you killed for $500. Everything would have been much easier. What stopped me from doing it was my son's poem. I wanted to kill you."
Makes my heart kind of hurt a little bit, you know, to hear you tell it in the way that you tell it. I know we're talking about a poem, but the whole story is poetic.
It's poetic. It is. It's divine. It's premonitions. It's being in the wrong place at the wrong time, or the right place at the wrong time, or it is really God-driven. Okay. I don't have all the answers to that. I pretty much choose to think that God has been along with me, but nothing came easy. I talked to God when I prayed. I said, "God, I know you're on my side. I know you're helping me accomplish this, okay? But why make it so hard?" Everything in this story is so ridiculously connected, okay? The day of the sentence, and we only get 15 years. And at the time, I didn't want to, I wanted to go to trial. But that even worked out ironically in the right direction. We were ready to go to trial. And I went home and I prayed on it. But this is what I did. In spite of me having all these things that my son encouraged me to do and all this kind of stuff, the only way I justified going in the next day and taking that plea deal was I said, you know what? I'm going to take the plea deal. And when he gets out, I'm going to kill him. But I don't think I've ever killed him. And I didn't mean that. I didn't really thought about my son's wishes and all this other kind of crap. And that night, for me to walk in that courtroom, I had to have a reason to justify what I was allowing to happen. Now, we leave, we go home. I'm already start thinking, well, I got to do this mission. So I was going to go to schools and talk and teach parents the warning signs and trying to prevent tragedies that way. We first said, we got to take a break. For a couple of months, I'm going to do nothing. No investigating and no advocacy work. The family needs a break from all this crap. Only one thing, I get home and my record machine is beeping. Back then, if you had a message.
On the answering machine.
So I press the button, and it's my son's creative writing teacher, the teacher that helped him with this poem. And he says, Mr. Snyder, I have no idea what's going on in the case. I just get home from the kid being sentenced and led away in cuffs. I go home, and it's beeping, and he says, in 2 weeks, we have Red Ribbon Week. We'd like you to come speak at the school. And I said, maybe I'll take a couple months off. Maybe I won't do this. I'm revved up. I'm pumped up, okay? There was a purpose for this phone call to come in when I came home from the hearing. God don't want you to take a pause.
No breaks. No breaks.
Yeah, no break, okay? So I go 2 weeks later, and then I go to college, and I go to schools. Meanwhile, you got kids coming in look like my son.
To your pharmacy, the kids are coming in, just so for people that don't know.
I was seeing 18-year-olds and 22-year-olds, kids with no helmets. And I'm looking at this, and there were a lot of pharmacists sitting out, but the doctor was legitimate. People that said OxyContin wasn't not addictive. Well, I knew that was bullshit.
I knew it.
Just recently starting addiction.
Because the pharmaceutical companies were saying it was not addictive. That was their sell.
Doctors were buying that crap, and I'll be honest with you. Prior to my son, this happened with my son, I might have bought it. Or at least the other way for a while. I'm keyed up on what I can do to save a life. What's going on out there that I'm missing, that everybody's missing? I call the DEA and the FBI, and I call the medical board, and I get like nowhere. They're not paying much attention to me. They seem to not like somebody from the outside. They don't even understand why I'm calling them and warning them this.
What strikes me is when you make this deal with God that, you know, if you can find your son's killer, if he'll help you with that, that you will serve him by saving other people, making sure that other people don't go through. Because I think that's exactly how I felt after my daughter died. I just wanted to make sure this didn't happen to anybody else.
They didn't die in vain. God has something to do with this. You can call it serendipity. You can call it coincidence. And I'm sad to say this again. I would have probably been like most pharmacists. And I would have probably looked the other way when I started seeing that. That's what 99% of the pharmacists did back then. And there's some guilt shared there. Had I not lost my son and been through the trauma and been so committed to try to prevent these tragedies, had that not happened, I would not have gotten involved and put doctors out of business. And I would not have had the investigatory tools either. So everything was trained for me to be a part of this. I told my wife one time, she said, look, you've already done enough. You shouldn't do this. It's going to be another risk. I said, who else is going to do it?
Dan says it took a series of unexpected events and an outright miracle for him to take his next step with his wife's support.
This is a crazy story. Anyway, the Saints, New Orleans Saints football team back then was kind of a joke. They were pretty horrible. But guess what happens the year that my son's case gets solved? They win a playoff game. This is the first ever playoff game we've ever won. Now that I've solved this case, it's almost like, hey, God's even going to let the Saints win the Super Bowl this year. Now, so I tell the wife, I said, look, we're supposed to take a break. I went and talked at a couple of schools. I'm thinking about this doctor. I gave them some information. I don't know where that's going to go. Let's take a trip to Minnesota. It was game number two. We drive all the way up there. And I just know the Saints are going to win this game because God is on my side. I'm on a roll. Okay, God has structured this for me to be here. Other things have been falling in place when I get the ass kicked. I mean, I couldn't believe it. You know, I was crushed. Okay. But let me tell you, we made a vacation on it. In fact, we went to the Mall of Americas. Okay. And remember, everything I did with the police was audio. I didn't really know how to use video. And actually, I think my video camera was old. So we had the Mall of Americas, and I see this newfangled camera that's small, and I buy this. And my wife says, that's an impulsive buy. This was a $1,500 camera, 20-some odd years.
I remember those. I had one of those little cameras about that time, too.
I justified buying it, okay, because we were on vacation. I want to take some pictures of the Saints game. I want to take some pictures of the snow, the river, and I do all that. And we got a good video. Now, we're on our way home. We bring a friend with us, and she's riding in the front seat with me. And in the back seat, my wife and my daughter are sleeping. And I'm telling Debbie, is her name, I'm saying, Debbie, I don't know what to do about this doctor. Okay, you know, I called the medical board. I don't really want to get involved in this. And she says, Schneider, you're going to do this. You're going to put out of business. And I said, Debbie, I said, look, that's easy for you to say, okay? But number one, I don't know what God wants to go talk to kids and parents and do all these other things, okay? And Annie doesn't want me doing this, my wife. And she says, I'm sorry, you're going to do this. And I said, well, you know what? If I'm going to do this, I'm going to have to get a different sign from God. Immediately out of the front windshield of the car, a cross appears. Now, you're probably going to be a little bit skeptical. You're buying my story, but you're probably going to say, well, it was there.
Sure, I'm skeptical by nature, so yes.
So was I. In fact, so much so that I thought I was hallucinating. I tell Debbie, I said, Debbie, what do you say? She's kind of a clairvoyant type of person, kind of a strange person. She believes in these kind of things. I don't really, okay? I see a cross, Schneider, just like it's normal. So I say to myself, I said, you know what? I just asked for this, and now we see this cross. My wife's sleeping. There's no way she's going to believe this. So I tell Debbie, let's wake him up. The cross continues to appear. Wake my daughter up and my wife up. And we said, look out of the front windshield of the car. Do you see anything? I see a cross. I see a cross. I don't know how you explain that other than a miracle.
Sure. Well, there's lots of ways to explain things away. But what is the harm? But
remember, I asked for this and I had three witnesses. How often does that happen?
It's pretty hard to argue with. So then you went right after the doctor, right after that, right? The pill mill doctor.
It's even better than this. We go home that night. We don't get home. We drive all night. It's 2:00 in the morning. Well, all my patients have been telling me that this doctor's open at 2:00 in the morning. There's hundreds of people out there.
Whoa.
So I don't believe them, but they've got to be exaggerated. I got to see. Okay. So I tell the wife, I got this new camera.
Oh, there is where the camera comes in.
Did not buy that camera when I bought it, thinking I was going to do that, but I had never done any video like this before. But the story gets even better. So now it's 2:00 in the morning. She says, I'm going with you. Why? She saw the cross.
So she came around.
She's saying, we are on a mission. Now, there would be times when this mission where she started having doubts and wondered whether we should be doing all this crap, okay? But at that moment, she wanted to go with me. She, at times, is helping me video. Sometimes she's shooting the footage. On 2:00 in the morning, all hundreds of people out there, and she's open.
Insane. That's insane. But you were able to shut her down. You were able to put her out of business. But that wasn't enough yet. Then you went after the pharmaceutical company.
Yes. And I think that's slightly overplayed. I did go after him, trying to.
It's the David and Goliath story, right?
It was way too big. I scratched the surface. The only reason why we even give me some credit there was is because I did write senators and I had copies of the letters. I made a phone call to Purdue, giving them some ideas on how they could reduce the problem. And all that was documented because I was at this stage now documenting almost everything I did. And somewhere along the line, I was starting to think, this might be a story I want to write a book about. I said, you know, these doctors, people are doctor shopping. They're bad doctors, but they're bad pharmacists out there too, because, you know, maybe they could justify filling the prescription for a patient that's been in their store. But we had a little network in my community. There was no pharmacy monitoring program at the time. But some of the better pharmacists sometimes would call and say, look, this patient just came in. Did you also fill a similar prescription? Sometimes we would catch people that were actually doctor shopping. Well, my intuitive investigative mind now, unlike a lot of people, started looking for solutions to this thing. And I found that in about three states at the time, they were experimenting with a pharmacy monitoring program, which would tell the pharmacists in each area that they were getting filled someplace else. And I said, well, we ought to try to do this. So then I went to war with trying to get that done. I contacted my pharmacy board. I said, look, they got this pharmacy monitor program. I think it'd really be a big help. We could cut down on overdoses and people doctor shop. Well, I got that. We're looking into this, but not at the time. So then I happened to have a friend that I went to pharmacy school with, and he is a newly elected board member on a pharmacy board. His name's Richard. So I called Richard up. And I said, Richard, look, I said, what can I do to try to impress upon the board? He says, well, number one, this is off the record. They don't want it.
Why didn't they want it? As a reporter, I have a vague memory of covering the story when South Dakota implemented the prescription monitoring in our state. But I don't remember any battle behind it. Why didn't they want it?
Strange. Richard actually helped. He says, tell you what, Dan, he says, what I would suggest that you do is try to build a case for this with some documents, okay? Send them a certified letter and ask for a response. They have to respond to you in writing. That puts them on record because I only got a verbal wording that they're not interested in this. Well, I go one better. I'm getting tough now, okay? There are doctors now that are getting sued of parents who lose kids. There are even some pharmacies being sued because the pharmacist is filling these things routinely. So I put together a package, and I thought, I said, you know what? Technology is available to prevent this from happening. There's going to be a parent that loses a kid that is going to sue the board, and you better get ready. Immediately, they go to work on a pharmacy monitoring program.
So it was just the threat of being sued is what it took.
Exactly. Somebody had to speak up in an intelligent way and give them the fear of God in them, okay, to do this. I helped other states get pharmacy monitoring programs. And so, you know, I started writing articles. I still would go talk in schools. I gave up investigating. I did shut down two other doctors. They were of lesser note than that doctor. And my wife finally reined me in and said, look, when is this going to end? And so I stopped investigating and I started doing what I originally intended to do, is talking to kids.
Advocacy work.
Typical advocacy, not investigative work.
Coming up in part two of my conversation with the pharmacist, Dan Schneider, we talk about his latest mission to get medically assisted treatment for opioid addiction more widely available and the activism he's doing right now to make it happen. You can listen to more episodes of Grieving Out Loud and read my blogs on our website, emilieshope.charity. Thanks for listening. Until next time, wishing you faith, hope, and courage.